It's been said that good things come in threes. Well, today's episode is a trifecta. First, dealing with the impossible turn, one of the most hotly debated maneuvers in GA. Second, helping to save the life of a VFR pilot lost in solid IMC. And third, acting quickly and decisively in a light twin to bring himself and his passengers to a safe landing. One pilot, three stories, and great lessons learned. On this episode of I Laughed, I learned about flying from that. Hello everyone, I'm Rob Ryder, and welcome to episode 78 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Insurance. In today's episode, I'll be chatting with Mark Henshaw, a flight instructor and first officer flying regional jets. Like so many people involved in aviation, his love for flying began as early as he can remember. He wrote to me, sharing three stories, all of which are significant, not only in what happened, but what he learned about flying from that, and all are from his GA experience. Lots of things done right. We'll get started right after this message from Avemco. The folks at Avemco Insurance are passionate about pilot safety. That's why they sponsor the FAA's Fast Team Wings program, published dozens of articles on safety techniques and human factors by noted CFIs, and even support I Learned About Flying From That. Visit avemco.com/flying or talk to them at 800-338-8705. Tell them you're an I Learned About Flying From That listener, and they'll even save you an additional 5% off your premium. Now, I Learned About Flying From That. My guest today on I Laughed is an ATP for a regional airline flying Embraer 175s, which is a pretty cool airplane to fly, even if you do have to hold the yoke like a handlebar instead of like a normal yoke. We'll True story indeed. But he's got several stories, and if we have time, I want to try to hit on all three. Mark Henshaw, thanks for being on I Laughed. Welcome.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be here and an honor to meet you. Been a longtime listener and reader.
Thank you, Mark. Flying Magazine is approaching its 100th year, and this is way more than just a job for me. It's kind of missional because of stories that people like you have brought to the table to share the lessons they've learned in the situations that they've encountered. But before we get to your I Laughed moments, tell me a little bit about your path to becoming a first officer. And as we record from Tucson, I guess you're in between flights. You're going to be flying out of here later on from this spot. But where did it all start for you, Mark?
It all started before I even could talk. I was in love with airplanes from day one, and I'm the only person in my family, so it's not like I got it from my father or someone else. But when I was 7 years old, my father, I used to beg him to take me to the airport to watch airplanes take off and land. And one day, a fellow offered us a ride in Twin Comanche. Not that I would know at the time what that was, but I can still see the silhouette of that airplane in my mind today. And I own a Twin Comanche today. So, yeah,
Where was that? And what airport was that, Mark?
That was Livermore, California, in the Bay Area.
Gotcha.
And later we moved to a little town called Marysville, close to Sacramento. And when I was 16, I mowed lawns until I had enough money for a Discovery flight in a Cessna 150 with a grumpy old instructor, but I could care less. I was flying an airplane, and I was in love.
I know a number of other pilots who have earned their money for their lessons by washing airplanes, by working on the lines, by hanging out, and it made such a big difference in their lives. But there is nothing like that first flight.
Yeah. It was memorable. It made a deep impression on my young mind, that's for sure.
Tell me about this grumpy old instructor, because quite frankly, sometimes a grumpy old instructor with more experience might be a better person to learn with than a young guy or gal who is instructing in order to build time to get an airline job and just move on out of instructing altogether.
Well, I've slept a few times since then. We're talking 1983 when that happened. And I was just so enamored with the experience of flying that I paid little attention to what he said. It was, I just remember that he was kind of sharp and kind of a little bit grumpy. But just the first time getting my hands on the controls, and we went north from Marysville and flew around the Sutter Buttes, which is the smallest mountain range in the world. But I just remember, wow, I'm flying an airplane.
Did you start your flight training right away?
No, by the time I could afford private training, I was living in Fallon, Nevada, and washing airplanes. In fact, I had a unique setup in my van because, you know, washing airplanes, I couldn't exactly taxi people's airplanes up to the water spigot. So I took an old water tank and laid it down in my van and installed a water spigot on the bottom and an air nozzle on top. And I would fill it 2/3 of the way with water and then drive my van to the local repair shop and use their air compressor to fill it up with air so I could watch airplanes mobile. That's how I earned money. That and I was a window washer. So that's how I earned money for getting my private.
After that, did you move swiftly through other ratings like your commercial instrument multi in order to get to where you are today? Or was that a circuitous path?
Honestly, it was a circuitous path. And it took quite a few years. And I wasn't necessarily on a track to become an airline pilot either. But after I got my private, I bought my first airplane. It was a 1959 Mooney M20A. Wood wing, still had the wood tail on it, was in great shape. Flew that for 5 years, did some of my instrument training in it, but it wasn't until after I sold it and joined a club that I finished my instrument rating at a 182, then added commercial. And then some years later, I was laid off up in Oregon and receiving unemployment. And I got a letter from the state inviting me to apply for funds to learn another industry. So I applied to be able to use it towards training to become a flight instructor. And they I had to jump through some hoops, but they approved it. And so that's how I got my CFI. And then I moved to Tijuana, Mexico, and started instructing in San Diego. And that's how I kind of built up my hours. And one day, I was right around 1,500 hours, and somebody suggested that I apply to SkyWest. And I'm like, I don't have enough experience for that. And the guy said, just put your resume in. 2 hours later, I was being interviewed on the phone. 2 days later, I was in Denver interviewing with SkyWest, and then they hired me the next day. And so I flew for them for a year and a half, and then I left there because of some commuting frustrations and some other things going on in my life. And I started flying charter in a P-210, Cessna P-210, and that led to meeting the people who hired me to buy them an Aerostar for their company. And I became their corporate pilot and managed the airplane, did the maintenance and all that. And then that company got sold, and so did the airplane. And so I started looking again, and that's how I ended up at Envoy, where I am now, flying the Embraer 175.
You mentioned the Mooney. You also mentioned flight instruction. Let's go to the first story that you shared with me, because you were at Gillespie Field in San Diego, and you were in the right seat of an airplane with a student in the left, and you had a little challenge when you took off from Gillespie Field. Now, San Diego's crowded. You don't have a lot of choices. If you have some problem on takeoff, you don't have big fields to go to, do you?
You sure do not. There's obstacles all over the place, unless you're out of Ramona or Brown Field, you know, to the north and to the south. But Gillespie Field, you know, is not a lot of options to put an airplane down. So, yeah.
When was it and what happened?
I don't have the dates in front of me. I think you probably do. But I was in a Piper Cherokee, and it was a pre-solo student. We were taking off from runway 27 right. And it was busy. They had split tower frequencies, so one frequency for one ray and another frequency for the other runway. And so we did a normal run-up. Everything seemed normal. We were taking off from 27 right to stay in the pattern. And the very busy tower controller suddenly said to offset to the left and fly the pattern for 27 left instead of 27 right. So we acknowledged that. And moments later, I began to realize something wasn't quite right. The engine was running smoothly, but it just felt anemic. It just didn't feel like we were climbing very well. And so I looked down at the RPM, and it's down to about 2,200 RPM, something like that. So the first thing
way
I,
low.
Yeah. So the first thing I did is I told my student my controls, and then I keyed up the mic and I told the tower, we have a problem. We're coming back and we're making right traffic. And the reason I did that, even though they assigned me left traffic, is because on that particular runway, on the upwind, if you turn left, you're going towards rising terrain and houses. But if you turn right, it's flat and industrial. So no time to ask permission. I just said, we got a problem. We're coming back and we're making right traffic.
And was that, in essence, a declaration of an emergency? And by the way, KSEE is Gillespie's identifier. If you want to look at that on a chart on your iPad or whatever, you can see what's going on. But it looks like you were making that right-hand turn to land to the south.
Yeah, so at the moment I said that, we were only about 400, maybe 500 feet in the air. And when I said that, the tower didn't respond, but I started a right turn. So now we're turning from the upwind, starting to turn crosswind. And I'd only made about 45 degrees a turn when the engine started getting rough. So I keyed up again, and I said, we got a rough engine. We need runway 17. So they said, you're cleared to land on runway 17. My next words were, we might not make the airport. At which point, my student got wide-eyed, because prior to that, he didn't realize the implications of this. So I said, yeah, we may not make the airport. And so they responded, if you need 9 left, you can have that as well, which is the same strip of pavement we left, opposite direction. But what started to happen, because I really thought the engine was going to quit and we were going to be landing on the freeway out there, but the engine started to surge. And as it surged, it kind of gave us pulses of energy, which helped us keep that turn going. We were essentially doing the impossible turn.
That's what was coming to my mind. To be able to make a 270-degree turn is just phenomenal.
Yeah, had the engine not continued surging, we would have been on the freeway. Either that or we would have been the next stall spin accident. And so the only way we got back to the runway is the engine continued to make a little bit of power intermittently, and we were just kind of able to continue that teardrop turn and land on runway 9 left, the same strip of pavement that we left.
Let me ask a couple of quick questions, and then we'll move on to the next incident, because I do want to get all these on, because you have some very interesting slices of information in each of these. Number one, what was the problem with the engine? Did you figure it out?
Yeah, I found out the next day that it was a failure of not the exhaust valve, but the intake valve on one of the four cylinders, and that's rare, because exhaust valves are usually the ones to fail. They take the most heat. And it was actually an engine that was still under warranty by Lycoming. So it was just a freak failure. And I also was kind of thinking later, you know, we lost one cylinder out of four. In theory, that's from 100% power down to 75% power. And a Cherokee will stay in the air, certainly, and maybe probably climb with that amount of power. But my theory is that with the intake valve failing, it was sending back pulses into the intake system that were probably interfering with the other cylinders.
Could very well be.
Because we definitely could not have stayed in the air much longer. There's no doubt about it.
Glad you made it back. The student, did he continue his training?
He did for a while, then he moved away and I lost track of him, so I'm not sure.
But he did get back on the horse, so to speak.
He did. And we talked the next day. We did a debrief. One thing I've been teaching my students always is when you're briefing your takeoff, always brief where you're going to go if you have an engine failure. And of course, that's a dynamically changing situation depending on where you lose the engine. But the point is, if you don't have a plan in advance, impromptu decisions in those situations are almost never good ones. So you need to know in advance, what's my plan if I have an engine failure? Where am I going to go?
Gotcha. Well, we jumped ahead. We actually learned the lesson, what you learned about flying from that. Let's go to the next one. By the way, that was back in 2017, according to what you initially wrote me. The second one was way, way back in 1999, where you were flying and became a comm relay for another pilot who was in trouble. you actually declared an emergency on someone else's behalf. Tell me about that flight and how that developed and where it all took place.
Yeah, so this was out of Salem, Oregon. This was my first airplane I alluded to earlier, the Mooney M20A. It had just come out of a fresh annual, and the couple of days later, we were planning a trip to Denver. And I never take an airplane fresh out of maintenance and fly it over terrain. I always do some shakedown cruises, get the bugs worked out, you know, close to the airport. And that's what I was doing this particular day. It was the month of May, and there was kind of some unstable weather patterns around. So there was, you know, plenty of good ceilings in the valley there, but the mountains were obscure, the Cascade Range. And so I'm overflying Independence Airport, which is just west of Salem. And even though I'm way above their pattern altitude, I decided to tune in their CTAF frequency. And on that frequency, I heard a mayday call. And I thought it was a woman because the person's voice was so high-pitched, they were panicky. And so I was responding to this mayday, but unbeknownst to me, this person had their volume turned down so they could not hear my replies. So it took me probably 30 minutes before he had the presence of mind to turn his volume up and to be able to hear my replies.
All this taking place on the CTAF.
On the CTAF, exactly. 122.8, I think, if memory serves. So, yeah, so finally, we established two-way communication, and I'm like, what's going on? And he tells me that he's in the clouds, lost, and low on fuel, and he's not instrument rated. So I said, well, look, first thing that we have to do is get you calm. And he said, I can't, blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, once we get you safely down on the ground, you're going to have a beer on me. But right now, I need you to calm down so that you can think clearly. And it was actually a man. He was so panicked that his voice was just really high-pitched. So then I said, look, we are going to do a frequency change together. So I want you, we're going to go to 125.8, that's Seattle Center, and we're going to declare an emergency on your behalf together. Can you do that? He's like, yeah. So go to 125.8, I key in. This is Mooney 911 Delta Romeo declaring an emergency in behalf of another pilot. And so I, you know, established two-way comm with Seattle Center, gave him the N number for the other guy. They could see him on radar, but they couldn't talk to him because he was too low. So the first thing they did was they said, he is on a southbound heading right now, and he's about to hit Mount Jefferson. Get him turned westbound. So we accomplished that, and so we got him turned west. And then, meantime, Seattle Center's doing business as usual with airliners, and finally I cut in and I said, could we clear the frequency? We've got an emergency going on here. So they did. They got everybody sent off to different frequencies so they could just focus on this guy. And he was starting to get calmer and calmer, starting to deal with the situation. And we had him almost over the valley there, the Willamette Valley, when suddenly I hear the words, my engine just quit. I think I'm out of gas. And so we told him, turn carb heat on. You know, we tried all the usual stuff to make sure that there wasn't some power available. And then pretty soon, nothing more. And then we heard an ELT. And so I started trying to track closer to the ELT, but I couldn't get within about 10 miles because the mountains were obscured and he went down in the mountains.
By any chance, did you use wing nulling by dipping a wing to block the signal to help locate the crash site?
No, I wasn't near that high tech. I just knew his approximate location was just trying to head in that direction, but he went down in the vicinity of Detroit Lake. He crashed at the 4,000-foot elevation level, I believe it was, right in the vicinity of Detroit Lake. But that entire area was obscured with clouds, and it wasn't just marine layer. I mean, it was fairly active weather, and so I couldn't get anywhere near the crash site. So I landed, and I went to bed that night thinking that that guy was not alive anymore. In fact, I went out and got good and drunk, to be frank
wow.
with you. It was a big impact because I had been his lifeline, was talking to him for over an hour, and suddenly my thought process was, this guy's not with us anymore.
At any point, was he indicating that he was having trouble maintaining attitude and keeping the aircraft level, or was he smart enough or trained enough to use the attitude indicator as his artificial horizon?
You know, he never said anything to me about, you know, getting into an extreme bank or anything like that. Although the fact that he was on a southbound heading might have been an indication that he was having trouble holding heading, or it might have just been lack of thought process. Hey, if you know, if you're in the Cascade Range, west is going to take you towards a safe place. South is going to either parallel or take you to the next peak. So I don't really know what was going on in his mind at that time, but I didn't get any indication that he had had any loss of control and then recovered or anything like that.
You said you consumed a fair amount of alcohol that evening. What happened? What was it like for you the next day?
After the hangover, I was at the hangar just, you know, puttering around on my airplane because I needed to distract myself. And I had the radio on. And around noon, I hear the on the news, they came on and said that the National Guard was pulling this guy off the mountain alive. He had survived. And so, of course, the first thing I did was I went out and bought the beer that I promised and drove up to Portland to the hospital where he was, put a ribbon around it, and presented it to him in the hospital room. So, yeah. And
he had to be thanking you from the bottom of his heart.
Well, it wasn't all me. I mean, certainly Seattle Center played their part. I couldn't see him on radar. So, I mean, I was just a link in the chain. But it was also just, you know, time and unforeseen occurrence. He had no visibility. He was solid IMC until impact. But he happened to hit the only spot on the bluff that was free of boulders and trees and all of that. And that's just sheer happenstance. I mean, how can you plan that, right? But once he was on the ground, then he started thinking clearly. He cut the headliner out, used it for a blanket, and did some other practical things that he could be found. But just, it was a miracle that he survived it all. I mean, how many people go into a mountain, solid IMC, until impact, and live to tell a story?
That's miraculous in my book. Let's, Mark, now go on to story number three. 2021, you're flying a Smith Aerostar as part of your work, and you got some folks aboard. Tell us what happened with that.
Yeah, so this was the airplane, the Aerostar that I flew corporately. I had two of that company's employees on board. We were flying from San Diego to Sacramento because they were going to go estimate a job up there. And we had just passed Bakersfield. I think we were halfway between Bakersfield and Fresno. It was a VMC day, severe clear. We were at 16,000 feet on an IFR flight plan. And I look at the oil pressure, and I notice that the oil pressure on the right engine is dropping. It hasn't hit red yet, but it's dropping. And I'm thinking, is that a real problem or is that a gauge issue? So I took the right throttle and brought it back quite a bit just to take it easy on the engine and continue to monitor. And about 30 seconds later, I noticed that oil temperature is rising. So I'm thinking, all right, this is real. This is not gauge. So I immediately pulled the right mixture, feathered the prop, declared an emergency, and told them we were going to make a U-turn and go back to Bakersfield. So actually, I didn't declare an emergency right away. I just told them, hey, I just feathered the right engine. We got an oil pressure problem. And they said, do you want to declare an emergency? And I said, absolutely, yes. I figured even though the weather's perfect and this was probably not a real stressful event, but still, when you got stuff going wrong, you're better off having all the resources on your side that you can. So I did not hesitate to declare an emergency. As it turns out, we were able to stay at 16,000 feet for 5 minutes on one engine until they cleared us lower. And then we landed at Bakersfield with one engine caged and had three fire trucks chasing me down the runway. Got the parade I've always wanted. So we pulled up to the FBO there, and the local maintenance shop must have gotten the news because the mechanic and the director of maintenance were standing there waiting for me, which was great. And they were so cool. They dropped everything so that they could address my problem. And it turned out to be an oil line on the back of the engine had come partially loose. By the time we landed, we had a quart and a half in the sump.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's not a lot for a 540. Is that what was in that?
It's an IO 540 Lycoming. I believe two quarts is the minimum, which is ridiculously low also, but Yeah, we were down to a quart and a half. We had not yet hit red line when I feathered it, so my thought process was the engine's probably okay. But I told him, I want you to change the oil. I want you to check the oil screen, which is in the sump. And I also want you to take the oil filter off, cut it open, and look for metal. They didn't find any metal. So when they completed the repairs, I took the airplane up and just orbited Bakersfield for an hour. And then I landed and taxied back up, and I said, now I want you to cut open the second oil filter and check for metal. And we also sent off for an oil sample as well to Black Labs, I believe it was. So I just wanted to make double sure that we weren't creating metal, that the engine wasn't going to be destroying itself.
Before we take a break, I have a question for you, and it's about your passengers. How did they respond to how you handled this engine out situation? And then how did they get to Sacramento?
Well, that's an interesting question. They actually rented a car, drove to Sacramento while I was getting the airplane repaired. During the actual event, they were quiet. They weren't panicky, but they were quiet. One of the guy that was sitting next to me in the co-pilot seat later told me, because he flew with me after that for on subsequent flights, and his wife said, "Are you crazy? You're going to do that?" And he said, "Well, look how it turned out. I mean, everything turned out good. We had two engines, not one, so we were able to make it to the airport, So, I'll fly again."
That sounds good. Time for the break. We'll come back and figure out what you learned about flying from that. We'll be right back. Ask your flight school or FBO if their insurance covers you when you rent their plane. The answer is almost certainly no. Even if they do, you'll probably still be on the hook for a big deductible. But for as low as $95 a year, an Avemco Insurance Company renter's policy will protect you with no deductible ever. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 and you'll be covered the next time you fly. Now, back to ILAFT. We are back with Mark Henshaw, flight instructor, airline pilot, corporate pilot, three wonderful stories, all of which had good endings, but they could have gone very, very badly on that first one with that 270 and then the extra 90 degrees to get you back on runway 9 left when you were there at Gillespie Field with your student in the airplane. The impossible turn is something that has been hotly debated, Mark. What did you learn about flying from that one?
Well, the first thing I learned, I alluded to it earlier, is always do a pre-takeoff briefing, whether it's a twin or a single, and decide if you lose an engine, where are you going to go? What's your strategy? The second thing that I learned is in the heat of the moment, don't wait for ATC to give you permission. You are now exercising emergency PIC authority, whether you've said the E word or not. Obviously, I did let them know what we were doing, so we didn't have a collision, but there was no time to ask for permission. It was just time to tell them, this is what we're doing, this is what's going on. And it was just unlike the Aerostar emergency, there wasn't a lot of time to communicate with ATC what's happening. I mean, we're at 500 feet and doing the impossible turn and contemplating landing on the freeway versus making a runway. And that was an ongoing, contemplation as well. And by the way, I reached over and tried mags. That didn't help. I contemplated trying to switch fuel tanks, but in the Cherokee, the fuel selector valve is on the sidewall by the pilot's knee, my student's left knee. I would not have been able to reach it, even trying to dive over his lap, and that was not the time to ask him to do it either. We were making some power, leave it alone. But the mag, checking the mags, that didn't help anything. So I knew, okay, this is a problem that we're not going to be able to fix in the air. So, of course, maintain the airspeed. Don't do anything dumb. Just keep flying the airplane all the way to the crash site, as I think Bob Hoover was famous for saying.
Fly the airplane as far into the crash as you can.
That's it. And that's what we were prepared to do. Fortunately, it ended up in a touchdown on the runway. One of the best landings I've ever made.
which is saying something for a left seat guy to be doing it from the right side.
Yeah. True story.
Good ending on that and good lessons learned. We have heard it before on this podcast. If the airplane is flying, don't mess with it.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, let's go to the second story. When you became a good Samaritan on behalf of another aviator who fortunately survived the crash into the mountains at 4,000 feet, you became his lifeline. Tell us what you learned about flying from that, because obviously he learned a lot about flying from that. But what did you learn?
Yeah, well, and actually touching on lessons from his perspective, just a little story. Prior to that flight that he made, he had not flown for, I think, 20 years or something like that. He had just recently gotten a flight review done, and he was trying to go from Lebanon, Oregon to Estacada, Oregon to look at an airplane for sale. And Estacada is in, it's not flat terrain. There's definitely terrain around, and the weather was very, very marginal. With, like I said, we're not talking just marine layer. We're talking some unstable weather and some, you know, some active weather in the mountains. And so the decision to make that flight when you're still fairly rusty, not necessarily the best decision to make. And what happened was he made three attempts to land at Estacada, but because of the crosswinds, he couldn't quite line it up right. So he gave up and decided to try to return to Lebanon. And he found himself trapped in a canyon, and the only way out is to go up. And so he started climbing, which put him in IMC. And from there, he got lost. And then, of course, his fuel situation started to become critical as well. So, you know, they talk about risk stacking. When you start stacking risks like that, the chances of something bad happening go up exponentially.
We have heard for years it's a series of little things, any one of which would not have been significant.
Yeah, and my personal minimums depend on how recently have I been flying, but also what equipment am I flying? Am I single engine or twin engine? And what avionics do I have? So, I mean, personally, when I do a risk assessment, it changes depending on the circumstances. It's not just, here's my minimums, I write them down and that's that. It's the minimums change depending on what the circumstances are and the equipment I'm flying, how tired I am, all that stuff.
Pre-flighting yourself as well as the airplane.
Exactly. And from my perspective on that incident, I learned that you sometimes need to be assertive with ATC. Frankly, I was surprised that they were trying to do business as usual when I just told them, you know, declared the emergency. We had already gotten the guy turned west, so they had already given me a vector to pass on to him. So they knew this was an emergency, and they're trying to do business as usual. And I had to step in and say, could we clear the frequency, which they promptly did. But sometimes you got to be assertive with ATC. Some of them are pilots, some of them are not. Some of them don't grasp the full implication of what might be happening in the moment. So you have to be, you know, clear and sometimes assertive with them.
In that case, had they been speaking to the pilot directly, they might have asked him if he was instrument rated and qualified and current.
Right.
But yeah. That didn't happen in the relay. Well, that's another good lesson. Be assertive if you have to. And if you got to declare an emergency, just do what you have to do. Both cases. Just be assertive. Let's go to the third story with the engine that failed in the Aerostar. What an amazing bit of repair work that you oversaw on that. What did you learn about flying from that?
Well, there again, I learned, you know, declaring emergency is not the big bad wolf that a lot of people think it is. I think I got a phone call out of that, and that was it. There was no hassles from the FAA or anything like that. And I do not regret that at all, declaring an emergency and just right up front saying, yeah, I'd like to declare an emergency. And just, you know, being in charge of the whole situation and of course, after the fact, just making sure that I don't have another emergency because of an engine failure on takeoff or shortly after from, you know, an engine that's now starting to make metal. You know, if you have a loss of oil pressure in flight, you want to be sure that it hasn't done some damage that's going to get worse. So just making sure that the maintenance shop followed through, making sure there was no metal in the oil filter both times was a good safety precaution.
In your case, you made the decision to shut down the engine and feather the prop before it could get any worse.
We were moments away from making metal. With a quart and a half of oil in the sump and with the rate of leakage that we had, we were moments away from an engine failure.
and a catastrophic one at that, and which would have done incredible damage. Turns out there was no damage to the engine. What had you thinking? What made you start to think like an A&P in order to direct these guys to cut two different oil filters open to make sure it wasn't the engine wasn't eating itself alive?
Well, two things. One is I am an A&P, so I think like one.
There you go.
Yeah. But the other one is I have to give a lot of credit to Mike Bush of Savvy Aviation. I'm also an avid, an addict of his webinars. And he talks about maintenance issues and he talks about cutting open oil filters and what you learn from that versus the oil screen versus, you know, other things in borescoping cylinders and all that. So for years now, I've been borescoping cylinders and really getting involved with, you know, kind of troubleshooting engine issues and also keeping an eye on what's happening internally with the engine. If you get a camber inside, you know, that's way more effective than, say, a compression test. So just having that mentality is what really kind of steered me in the right direction to figure out what's happened here with the engine after the fact and what do we need to do to address it.
Mike's quite a guy in that he believes in if it ain't broke, don't fix it, because he says sometimes if you take things apart, you increase the potential for failure when you put it back together, right?
Especially cylinders. Yeah, a lot of mechanics will change cylinders like they change their socks, and if they don't use the right procedures, that can result in a catastrophic engine failure. So yeah, Mike has contributed quantumly to my A&P education, just listening to his podcasts.
Mark Henshall, thank you for being on I Laughed.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark's experience as an A&P and the very methodical way he approached the repair of his engine, changing filters after an hour of test flying and then cutting it open to inspect for any metal, really got my attention. Thank you again, Mark, for sharing so much with us. Keep your stories coming. I'm grateful for your submissions, and I will get to as many as I can. My address is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. Thanks again for listening. I hope you'll subscribe if you haven't done so already. Share it with your friends, even if they're not aviation people. The stories are still pretty good for the non-flyer as well as all of us pilots. I Laughed is available wherever you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks, so you can hear the first-hand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. The I Laughed theme and commercial instrumental music for the podcast was written and performed by Rob Potorf. Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed, and Kate O'Connor is managing editor of Flying Magazine. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.